If you clenched your teeth hard enough and took enough strides, you could get anywhere. One painful, weary, freezing, guilty step at a time. What else could you do? No sooner had they finally made it to the top of the hill than Prince Ladislaw flung himself down against the roots of a tree, as he did at least once an hour.
"Colonel West, please!"
he gasped for air, breath steaming round his puffy face. He had two lines of glistening snot on his pale top lip, just like a toddler.
"I can go no further. Tell him to stop, for pity's sake."
West cursed under his breath. The Northmen were annoyed enough as it was, and making less and less effort to disguise the fact. But, like it or not, Ladislaw was still his commander, not to mention the heir to the throne. West could hardly order him to get up.
"Three threes,"
he wheezed. The old warrior frowned over his shoulder.
"You better not be asking me to stop, lad."
"We have to."
"By the dead, again? You southerners got no bones in you at all. No wonder Bethod gave you such a kicking. If you bastards don't learn to march, he'll be giving you another, I can tell you that."
"Please, just for a moment."
Three Threes glared down at the sprawling prince and shook his head with disgust.
"All right, then. You can sit a minute, if that'll get you moving the quicker. But don't get used to it, you hear? We've not covered half the ground we need to today if we're to keep ahead of Bethod."
And he stalked off to shout at the dogman. West sank down onto his haunches, working his numb toes, cupping his icy hands and blowing into them. He wanted to sprawl out like Ladislaw, but he knew from harsh experience that if he stopped moving, starting up again would be all the more painful. Pike and his daughter stood over them, scarcely even too far out of breath. It was harsh proof, if any were really needed, that working metal in a penal colony was better preparation for slogging across brutal country than a life of uninterrupted ease. Ladislaw seemed to guess what he was thinking.
"You've no idea how hard this is for me," he blurted.
"No, of course,"
snapped West, his patience worn down to a stub.
"You've got the extra weight of my coat to carry."
The prince blinked, then looked down at the wet ground, his jaw muscles working silently.
"You're right. I'm sorry. I realize I owe you my life, of course. Not used to this sort of thing, you see. Not used to it at all."
He plucked at the frayed and filthy lapels of the coat and gave a sorry chuckle.
"My mother always told me that a man should be well presented under all circumstances. I wonder what she'd make of this."
West noticed he didn't offer to give it back, though. Ladislaw hunched his shoulders.
"I suppose I must shoulder a portion of the blame for this whole business."
A portion? West would have liked to serve him a portion of his boot.
"I should have listened to you, Colonel. I knew it all along. Caution is the best policy in war, eh? That's always been my motto. Let that fool Smund talk me into rashness. He always was an idiot."
"Lord Smund gave his life," muttered West.
"Shame he didn't give it a day earlier. We might not be in this fix."
The prince's lip quivered slightly.
"What do you think they'll say about this back home, eh, West? What do you think they'll say about me now?"
"I've no idea, Your Highness."
It could hardly be any worse than what they said already. West tried to squash his anger and put himself in Ladislaw's position. He was so utterly unprepared for the hardship of this march, so completely without resources, so entirely dependent on others for everything. A man who had never had to make a decision more important than which hat to wear, who now had to come to terms with his responsibility for thousands of deaths. Small wonder he had no idea how to go about it.
"If only they hadn't run."
Ladislaw clenched his fist and thumped petulantly at a tree root.
"Why didn't they stand and fight, the cowardly bastards? Why didn't they fight?"
West closed his eyes, did his best to ignore the cold and the hunger and the pain, and to push away the fury in his chest. This was always the way of it. Just when Ladislaw was finally starting to arouse some sympathy, he would let fall some loathsome utterance which brought West's distaste for the man flooding back.
"I couldn't possibly say, Your Highness," he managed to squeeze through his gritted teeth.
"Right," grumbled Three Trees. "That's your lot. On your feet again and no excuses."
"Not up again already, is it, Colonel?"
"I'm afraid so." The prince sighed and dragged himself wincing to his feet.
"I've no notion of how they can keep this up, West."
"One stride at a time, Your Highness."
"Of course,"
muttered Ladislaw, starting to stumble off through the trees after the two convicts.
"One stride at a time."
West worked his aching ankles for a moment and then bent down to follow, when he felt a shadow fall across him. He looked up to see that Black Dow had stepped into his path, blocking the way with one heavy shoulder, his snarling face no more than a foot away. He nodded towards the prince's slow-moving back.
"You want me to kill him?" he growled in Northern.
"If you touch any one of them!"
West had spat out the words before he had any idea of how to finish.
"I'll... yes. I'll kill you."
What else could he say? He felt like a child making ludicrous threats in a schoolyard. An extremely cold and dangerous schoolyard, and to a boy twice his size. But Dow only grinned.
"That's a big temper you got on you for a skinny man. A lot of killing we're talking about all of a sudden. You sure you got the bones for it?"
West tried to look as big as he could, which wasn't easy standing down a slope and hunched over with exhaustion. You have to show no fear if you're to calm a dangerous situation, however much you might be feeling.
"Why don't you try me?"
His voice sounded pitifully weak, even in his own ear.
"I might do that."
"Let me know when it's time. I'd hate to miss it."
"Oh, don't worry about that,"
whispered Dow, turning his head and spitting on the ground.
"You'll know it's time when you wake up with your throat cut."
And he sauntered off up the muddy slope, slow enough to show he wasn't scared. West wished that he could have said the same. His heart was pounding as he pushed on between the trees after the others. He trudged doggedly past Ladislaw and caught up to Cathil, falling into step beside her.
"You all right?" he asked. "I've been worse."
She looked him up and down.
"How about you?"
West suddenly realized what a state he must look. He had an old sack with holes cut in it for his arms, pulled over his filthy uniform, his belt buckled tight over the top with the heavy sword pushed through it and knocking against his leg. There was an itchy growth of half-beard across his rattling jaw, and he guessed that his face must have been a mixture of angry pink and corpse grey. He wedged his hands under his armpits and gave a sad grin.
"Cold. You look it. Should have kept your coat, maybe."
He had to nod at that. He peered through the branches of the pines at Dow's back and cleared his throat.
"None of them have been bothering you, have they?"
"Bothering me?"
"Well, you know," he said awkwardly, "a woman in amongst all these men, they're not used to it. The way that man Dow stares at you, I don't..."
"That's very noble of you, Colonel, but I wouldn't worry about them. I doubt they'll do anything more than stare, and I've dealt with worse than that."
"Worse than him?"
"First camp I was in, the Commandant took a liking to me. Still had the glow of a good free life on my skin, I suppose. He starved me to get what he wanted. 5 days with no food."
West winced.
"And that was long enough to make him give up?"
"They don't give up. 5 days was all I could stand. You do what you have to."
"You mean..."
"What you have to."
She shrugged.
"I'm not proud, but I'm not ashamed either. Pride and shame, neither one will feed you. The only thing I regret is those 5 days of hunger. 5 days when I could have eaten well."
"You do what you have to. I don't care who you are.
once you start starving.
She shrugged again.
What about your father?
Pike.
She looked up at the burnt-faced convict ahead of them.
He's a good man, but he's no relative of mine. I've no idea what became of my real family. Split up all over Angland, probably, if they're still alive.
So he's...
Sometimes, if you pretend you're family, people act differently. We've helped each other out. If it wasn't for Pike, I suppose I'd still be hammering metal in the camp.
Instead of which you're enjoying this wonderful outing.
Ha! You make do with what you're given.
She put her head down and quickened her pace, stalking off through the trees. West watched her go. She had some bones to her, the Northmen would have said. Ladislaw could have learned a thing or two from her tight-lipped determination. West looked over his shoulder at the prince, stumbling daintily through the mud with a petulant frown on his face. He blew out a smoky sigh. It seemed that it was far too late for Ladislaw to learn anything. A miserable meal of a chunk of old bread and a cup of cold stew. Three Trees wouldn't let them have a fire, for all of Ladislaw's begging. Too much risk of being seen. So they sat and spoke quietly in the gathering gloom, a little way from the Northmen. Talking was good, if only to keep one's mind from the cold and the aches and the discomfort, if only to stop one's teeth from chattering.
You said you fought in Canter, eh, Pike? In the war?
That's right. I was a sergeant there.
Pike nodded slowly, his eyes glittering in the pink mess of his face.
Hard to believe we were always too hot, eh?
West gave a sad gurgle, the closest thing to a laugh that he could manage.
Which was your unit? I was in the 1st Regiment of the King's Own Cavalry, under Colonel Glockter.
But that was my regiment.
I know.
I don't remember you.
Pike's burns shifted in a way that West thought might have been a smile.
I looked different back then. I remember you, though, Lieutenant West. The men liked you. Good man to go to with a problem.
West swallowed. He wasn't much for fixing problems now, only for making them.
So, how did you end up in the camp?
Pike and Cathill exchanged glances.
In general, among the convicts, you don't ask.
Oh. West looked down, rubbed his hands together.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to offend you.
No offense. Pike sniffed and rubbed at the side of his melted nose.
I made some mistakes. Let's leave it at that. You got a family waiting for you?
West winced, folded his arms tight across his chest.
I have a sister, back home in Adua. She's... complicated.
He thought it best to end there.
You?
I had a wife. When I was sent here, she chose to stay behind. I used to hate her for it, but you know what? I can't say I wouldn't have done the same.
Ladislaw emerged from the trees, wiping his hands on the hem of West's coat.
That's better. Must have been that damn meat this morning.
He sat down between West and Cathill, and she scowled as if someone had dropped a shovel full of shit next to her. It was safe to say the two of them were not getting on.
What were we speaking of?
West winced.
Pike was just mentioning his wife.
Oh, you know, of course, that I am engaged to be married to the Princess Therese, daughter of Grand Duke Orso of Talons. She is a famous beauty.
Ladislaw trailed off, frowning round at the shadowy trees, as if even he was dimly aware of how bizarre talk of such matters seemed in the wilds of Angland.
Though I am beginning to suspect that she is less than entirely delighted with the match.
One can't imagine why,
murmured Cathill, at least the 10th jibe of the evening.
I am the heir to the throne, snapped the prince, and will one day be your king. It would not hurt anyone for you to treat me with a measure of respect.
She laughed in his face.
I've no country and no king and certainly no respect for you.
Ladislaw gasped with indignation. I will not be spoken to like...
Black Dow loomed up over them from nowhere.
Shut his fucking mouth,
he snarled in Northern, stabbing at the air with one thick finger.
Befford might have ears anywhere. Stop his tongue flapping, or it's coming out.
And he melted away into the shadows.
He would like us to be quiet, Your Highness,
translated West in a whisper. The prince swallowed.
So I gather.
He and Cathill hunched their shoulders and glared at each other in silence. West lay on his back on the hard ground, the canvas creaking just above his face, watching the snow fall gently down beyond the black lumps of his boots. Cathill was pressed up against him on one side, the dogman on the other. The rest of the band were all around, squeezed in tight together under a great smelly blanket. All except for Dow, who was out there taking watch. Cold like this was an amazing thing for making people familiar with each other. There was a rumbling snore coming from the far end of the group. Three Trees or Tull, probably. The dogman tended to twitch a lot in his sleep, jolting and stretching and twittering meaningless sounds. Ladislaw's breath wheezed out on the right, chesty sounding and weak. All sleeping, more or less, as soon as they put their heads down. But West could not sleep. He was too busy thinking about all the hardships and the defeats and the terrible dangers they were in. And not only them. Marshal Burr might be out there in the forests of Angland somewhere, hurrying south to the rescue, not knowing that he was falling into a trap, not knowing that Bethod was expecting him. The situation was dire, but against all reason, West's heart felt light. The fact was, out here, things were simple. There were no daily battles to be fought, no prejudices to overcome, no need to think more than an hour ahead. He felt free for the first time in months. He winced and stretched his aching legs, felt Cathill shift in her sleep beside him, her head falling against his shoulder, her cheek pressing into his dirty uniform. He could feel the warmth of her breath on his face, the warmth of her body through their clothes. A pleasant warmth. The effect was only slightly spoiled by the stink of sweat and wet earth and the dogman squeaking and muttering in his other ear. West closed his eyes, the faintest grin on his face. Perhaps things could still be put right. Perhaps he still had the chance to be a hero. If he could just get Ladislaw back alive to Lord Marshal Burr. Chapter 30. The Rest is Wasted Breath. Pharaoh rode and watched the land. Still they followed the dark water, still the wind blew cold through her clothes, still the looming sky was heavy with chaos, and yet the country was changing. Where it had been flat as a table, now it was full of rises and sudden hidden troughs. Land that men could hide in. And she did not like that thought. Not that she was fearful, for Pharaoh Mal'jin feared no man. But she had to look and listen all the more carefully for signs that anyone had passed, for signs that anyone was waiting. That was simple good sense. The grass had changed as well. She had grown used to it all around, tall and waving in the wind, but here it was short and dry and withered pale, like straw. It was getting shorter, too, as they went further. Today there were bald patches scattered round, bare earth where nothing grew, empty earth, like the dust of the Badlands. Dead earth. And dead for no reason that she could see. She frowned out across the crinkled plain, out towards far distant hills, a faint and ragged line above the horizon. Nothing moved in all that vast space. Nothing but them and the impatient clouds. And one bird, hovering high, high up, almost still on the air, long feathers on its dark wingtips fluttering.
First bird I've seen in 2 days, grunted Nine Fingers, peering up at it suspiciously.
Huh, she grunted. The birds have more sense than us. What are we doing here?
Got nowhere better to be.
Pharaoh had better places to be. Anywhere there were Gurkish to kill.
Speak for yourself.
What? You got a crowd of friends back in the Badlands all asking after you? Where did Pharaoh get to? The laugh's all dried up since she went away.
And he snorted as if he had said something funny. Pharaoh did not see what.
We can't all be as well loved as you, Pink.
She gave a snort of her own.
I'm sure they will have a feast ready for you when you get back to the north.
Oh, there'll be a feast, all right. Just as soon as they've hung me.
She thought about that for a minute, looking sideways at him from the corners of her eyes. Looking without turning her head, so if he glanced over, she could flick her eyes away and pretend she never was looking at all. She had to admit, now that she was getting used to him, the Big Pink was not so bad. They had fought together more than once, and he had always done his share. They had agreed to bury each other, if need be, and she trusted him to do it. Strange looking, strange sounding, but she had yet to hear him say he would do a thing and see him not do it, which made him one of the better men she had known. Best not to tell him that, of course, or give away the slightest sign that she thought it. That would be when he let her down.
You got no one, then?
She asked.
No one but enemies.
Why aren't you fighting them?
Fighting? It's got me everything I have.
And he held his big empty hands up to show her.
Nothing but an evil reputation and an awful lot of men with a burning need to kill me. Fighting? The better you are at it, the worse off it leaves you. I've settled some scores, and that can feel grand, but the feeling don't last long. Vengeance won't keep you warm nights, and that's a fact. Overrated. Won't do on its own. You need something else.
Pharaoh shook her head.
You expect too much out of life, Pink.
He grinned.
And here was me thinking you expect too little.
Expect nothing, and you won't be disappointed.
Expect nothing, and you'll get nothing.
Pharaoh scowled at him. That was the thing about talk. Somehow it always took her where she did not want to go. Lack of practice, maybe. She jerked her reins and nudged her horse off with her heels, away from Nine Fingers and the others, out to the side on her own. Silence, then. Silence was dull, but it was honest. She frowned across at Luther, sitting up in the cart, and he grinned back like an idiot, as wide as he could with bandages over half his face. He seemed different somehow, and she did not like it. Last time she had changed his dressings, he had thanked her, and that seemed odd. Pharaoh did not like thanks. They usually hid something. It niggled at her to have done something that deserved a thanking. Helping others led to friendships. Friendships led to disappointment at best, at worst, betrayal. Luthar was saying something to Nine Fingers now, talking up to him from down in the cart. The Northman tipped back his head and roared with stupid laughter, making his horse startle and nearly dump him to the ground. Baez swayed contentedly in his saddle, happy creases round the corners of his eyes as he watched Nine Fingers fumble with his reins. Pharaoh scowled off across the plain. She had much preferred it when no one had liked each other. That was comfortable and familiar. That she understood. Trust and comradeship and good humour, these things were so far in the past for her that they were almost unknown. And who likes the unknown? Pharaoh had seen a lot of dead men. She had made more than her share. She had buried a good few with her own hands. Death was her trade and her pastime. But she had never seen near so many corpses all at once. The sickly grass was scattered with them. She slid down from her saddle and walked among the bodies. There was nothing to tell who fought who or one side from the other. The dead all look alike. Especially once they've been picked over. Their armor and their weapons and half their clothes taken. They lay heaped thick and tangled in one spot in the long shadow of a broken pillar. An ancient-looking thing, split and shattered, crumbling stone sprouting with withered grass and spotted with lichen. A big black bird sat on top of it,
wings folded, peering at Pharaoh with beady, unblinking eyes as she came close. The corpse of a huge man was lying half-propped against the battered stone below, a broken staff still gripped in his lifeless hand, dark blood and dark dirt crusted under the nails. Most likely the staff had held a flag, Pharaoh thought. Soldiers seemed to care a great deal for flags. She had never understood that. You could not kill a man with one. You could not protect yourself with one. And yet men would die for flags.
"Foolishness,"
she muttered, frowning up at the big bird on the pillar.
"A massacre," said Nine Fingers.
Baez grunted and rubbed his chin.
"But of who? By whom?"
Pharaoh could see Luthar's swollen face peering wide-eyed and worried over the side of the cart. Kwai was just in front of him on the driver's seat, the reins dangling loose in his hands, his face expressionless as he looked down at the corpses. Pharaoh turned over one of the bodies and sniffed at it. Pale skin, dark lips, no smell yet.
"It did not happen long ago, 2 days maybe."
"But no flies?"
Nine Fingers frowned at the bodies. A few birds were perched on them, watching.
"Just birds. And they're not eating. Strange."
"Not really, friend."
Pharaoh jerked her head up. A man was striding quickly towards them across the battlefield, a tall pink in a ragged coat, a gnarled length of wood in one hand. He had an unkempt head of greasy hair, a long, matted beard. His eyes bulged bright and wild in a face carved with deep lines. Pharaoh stared at him, not sure how he could have come so close without her noticing. The birds rose up from the bodies at the sound of his voice, but they did not scatter from him. They flew towards him, some settling on his shoulders, some flapping about his head and round him in wide circles. Pharaoh reached for her bow, snatching at an arrow, but Baez held out his arm.
"No!"
"Do you see this?"
The tall pink pointed at the broken pillar, and the bird flapped from it and across onto his outstretched finger.
"A 100-mile column. 100 miles to Alcus."
He dropped his arm, and the bird hopped onto his shoulder next to the others, and sat there still and silent.
"You stand on the very borders of the Deadland. No animals come here that are not made to come."
"How now, brother?" called Baez,
and Pharaoh shoved her arrow unhappily away.
"Another Magus. She might have guessed. Whenever you put two of these old fools together, there was sure to be a lot of lips flapping, a lot of words made, and that meant a lot of lies."
"The great Baez,"
shouted the new arrival as he came closer.
"The first of the Magi. I heard tell you were coming from the birds of the air, the fish of the water, the beasts of the earth. And now I see with my own eyes, and yet still I scarcely believe. Can it be that those blessed feet should touch this bloody ground?"
He planted his staff on the earth, and as he did, the big black bird scrambled from his shoulder and grasped the tip with its claws, flapping its wings until it was settled. Pharaoh took a cautious step back, putting one hand on her knife. She did not intend to be shat on by one of those things.
"Zacharus,"
said Baez, swinging down stiffly from his saddle, although it seemed to Pharaoh he said the name with little joy.
"You look in good health, brother."
"I look tired. I look tired and dirty and mad, for that is what I am. You are difficult to find, Baez. I have been searching all across the plain and back."
"We have been keeping out of sight. Kalul's allies are seeking for us also."
Baez's eyes twitched over the carnage.
"Is this your work?"
"That of my charge, young Galtus. He is fierce as a lion, I tell you, and makes as fine an emperor as the great men of old. He has captured his greatest rival, his brother Scario, and has shown him mercy."
Zacharus sniffed.
"Not my advice, but the young will have their way. These were the last of Scario's men, those who would not surrender."
He he flapped a careless hand at the corpses, and the birds on his shoulders flapped with him.
"Mercy only goes so far," observed Baez.
"They would not run into the deadland, so here they made their stand, and here they died, in the shadow of the 100-mile columns. Galtus took the standard of the 3rd Legion from them, the very standard that Stolichus himself rode into battle under, a relic of the old time, just as you and I are, brother."
Baez did not seem impressed.
"A piece of old cloth. It did these fellows precious little good. Carrying a stretch of moth food does not make a man, Zacharus."
"Perhaps not. The thing is much faded, truth be told. Its jewels were all torn out and sold long ago to buy weapons."
"Jewels are a luxury in these days, but everyone needs weapons. Where is your emperor now?"
"Already on his way back eastwards, with no time even to burn the dead. He is heading for Darmium, to lay siege to the city and hang this madman Cabrian from the walls. Then perhaps we can have peace."
Baez gave a joyless snort.
"Do you even remember what it feels like to have peace?"
"You might be surprised at what I remember."
And Zacharus's bulging eyes stared down at Baez.
"But how are matters in the wider world? How is Yulwe?"
"Watching, as always."
"And what of our older brother, the shame of our family, the great prophet Kalul?"
Baez's face grew hard.
"He grows in strength. He begins to move. He senses his moment has come."
"And you mean to stop him, of course."
"What else should I do?"
"Kalul was in the south when last I heard, yet you journey westward. Have you lost your way, brother? There is nothing out here but the ruins of the past."
"There is power in the past."
"Power? You never change. Strange company you ride with, Baez. Young Malachus Quai I know, of course. How goes it, teller of tales?"
he called out to the apprentice.
"How goes it, talker? How does my brother treat you?"
Quai stayed hunched on his cart. "Well enough."
"Well enough? That's all? You have learned to stay silent, then, at least. How did you teach him that, Baez? That I never could make him learn."
Baez frowned up at Quai.
"I hardly had to."
"So, what did Juven say? The best lessons one teaches oneself."
Zacharus turned his bulging eyes on Pharaoh, and the eyes of his birds turned with him, all as one.
"This is a strange one you have here."
"She has the blood."
"You still need one who can speak with the spirits."
"He can."
Baez nodded his head at Nine Fingers. The big pink had been fiddling with his saddle, but now he looked up, bewildered.
"Him?"
Zacharus frowned. Much anger, Pharaoh thought, but some sadness and some fear. The birds on his shoulders and his head and the tip of his staff stood tall and spread their wings and flapped and squawked.
"Listen to me, brother, before it is too late. Give up this folly. I will stand with you against Kalul. I will stand with you and Yulwe, the three of us together, as it was in the old time, as it was against the Maker, the Magi united. I will help you."
There was a long silence, and hard lines spread out across Baez's face.
"You will help me?
If only you had offered your help long ago after the Maker fell, when I begged you for it. Then we might have torn up Kalul's madness before it put down roots. Now the whole south swarms with eaters, making the world their playground, treating the solemn word of our master with open scorn. The three of us will not be enough, I think."
"What then? Will you lure Cornel from her books? Will you find Leru? under whatever stone she has crawled beneath in all the wide circle of the world? Will you bring Carnolt back from across the wide ocean, or Anselmi and Broken Tooth from the land of the dead? The Magi united, is it?"
And Baez's lip curled into a sneer.
"That time is done, brother. That ship sailed long ago, never to return, and we were not on it."
"I see,"
hissed Zacharus, red-streaked eyes bulging wider than ever.
"And if you find what you seek, what then? Do you truly suppose that you can control it? Do you dare to imagine that you can do what Glustrod and Canadius and Juvens himself could not?"
"I am the wiser for their mistakes."
"I hardly think so. You would punish one crime with a worse."
Baez's thin lips and hollow cheeks turned sharper still. No sadness, no fear, but much anger of his own.
"This war was not of my making, brother. Did I break the second law? Did I make slaves of half the South for the sake of my vanity?"
"No, but we each had our part in it, and you more than most. Strange how I remember things that you leave out. How you squabbled with Kalul, how Juvens determined to separate you, how you sought out the Maker, persuaded him to share his secrets."
Zacharus laughed, a harsh cackle, and his birds croaked and squawked along with him.
"I dare say he never intended to share his daughter with you, eh, Baez? The Maker's daughter, Ptolemy? Is there room in your memory for her?"
Baez's eyes glittered cold. "Perhaps the blame is mine," he whispered. "The solution shall be mine also."
"Do you think Eos spoke the first law on a whim? Do you think Juvens put this thing at the edge of the world because it was safe? It is evil."
"Evil?"
Baez snorted his contempt.
"A word for children, a word the ignorant use for those who disagree with them. I thought we grew out of such notions long centuries ago."
"But the risks."
"I am resolved."
And Baez's voice was iron and well sharpened.
"I have thought for long years upon it. You have said your piece, Zacharus, but you have offered me no other choices. Try and stop me if you must. Otherwise, stand aside."
"Then nothing has changed."
The old man turned to look at Pharaoh, his creased face twitching, and the dark eyes of his birds looked with him.
"And what of you, devil blood? Do you know what he would have you touch? Do you understand what he would have you carry? Do you have an inkling of the dangers?"
A small bird hopped from his shoulder and started twittering round and round Pharaoh's head in circles.
"You would be better to run and never to stop running. You all would."
Pharaoh's lip curled. She slapped the bird out of the air, and it clattered to the ground, hopping and tweeting away between the corpses. The others squawked and hissed and clucked their anger, but she ignored them.
"You do not know me, old fool pink with a dirty beard. Do not pretend to understand me, or to know what I know, or what I have been offered. Why should I prefer the word of one old liar over another? Take your birds and keep your nose to your own business, then we will have no quarrel. The rest is wasted breath."
Zacharus and his birds blinked. He frowned, opened his mouth, then shut it silently again, as Pharaoh swung herself up into her saddle and jerked her horse round towards the west. She heard the sounds of the others following, hooves thumping, Kwai cracking the reins of the cart, then Baez's voice.
"Listen to the birds of the air, the fish of the water, the beasts of the earth. Soon you will hear that Kalul has been finished, his eaters turned to dust, the mistakes of the past buried as they should have been long ago."
"I hope so, but I fear the news will be worse."
Pharaoh looked over her shoulder and saw the two old men exchanging one more stare.
The mistakes of the past are not so easily buried. I earnestly hope that you fail.
Look around you, old friend.
And the first of the Magi smiled as he clambered up into his saddle.
None of your hopes ever come to anything.
And so they rode away from the corpses in silence, past the broken 100-mile column and into the deadland, towards the ruins of the past, towards Alcus, under a darkening sky. Chapter 31 A Matter of Time. To Archlector Sult, head of His Majesty's Inquisition. Your Eminence, 6 weeks now we have held the Gurkish back. Each morning they brave our murderous fire to tip earth and stone into our ditch. Each night we lower men from the walls to try and dig it out. In spite of all our efforts, they have finally succeeded in filling the channel in two places. Daily now, scaling parties rush forward from the Gurkish lines and set their ladders, sometimes making it onto the walls themselves, only to be bloodily repulsed. Meanwhile, the bombardment by catapults continues, and several sections of the walls are dangerously weakened. They have been shored up, but it might not be long before the Gurkish have a practicable breach. Barricades have been raised on the inside to contain them should they make it through into the lower city. Our defences are tested to the limit, but no man entertains a thought of surrender. We will fight on. As always, Your Eminence, I serve and obey. San Dan Glockta, Superior of Dagoska. Glockta held his breath, licking at his gums as he watched the dust clouds settling across the roofs of the slums through his eyeglass. The last crashes and clatters of falling stones faded, and Dagoska, for that one moment, was strangely silent. The world holds its breath. Then the distant screaming reached him on his balcony, thrust out from the wall of the citadel high above the city. A screaming he remembered well from battlefields both old and new. And hardly happy memories. The Gurkish war cry, "The enemy are coming." Now he knew they were charging across the open ground before the walls, as they had done so many times these past weeks. But this time they have a breach. He watched the tiny shapes of soldiers moving on the dust-coated walls and towers to either side of the gap. He moved his eyeglass down to take in the wide half-circle of barricades, the triple ranks of men squatting behind them, waiting for the Gurkish to come. Glockta frowned and worked his numb left foot inside his boot. A meager-seeming defense indeed, but all we have. Now Gurkish soldiers began to pour through the yawning breach like black ants swarming from a nest. A crowd of jostling men, twinkling steel, waving banners, emerging from the clouds of brown dust, scrambling down the great heap of fallen masonry and straight into a furious hail of flatbow bolts. First through the breach, an unenviable position. The front ranks were mown down as they came on, tiny shapes falling and tumbling down the hill of rubble behind the walls. Many fell, but there were always more, pressing in over the bodies of their comrades, struggling forward over the mass of broken stones and shattered timbers and into the city. Now another cry floated up, and Glockta saw the defenders charge from behind their barricades. Union soldiers, mercenaries, Dagoskans, all hurled themselves towards the breach. At this distance, it all seemed to move with absurd slowness. A stream of oil and a stream of water dribbling towards one another. They met, and it became impossible to tell one side from the other. A flowing mass, punctuated by glittering metal, rippling and surging like the sea, a colourful flag or two hanging limp above. The cries and screams hung over the city, echoing, shifting with the breeze. The far-off swell of pain and fury, the clatter and din of combat. Sometimes it sounded like a distant storm, incomprehensible. Sometimes a single cry or word would float to Glockta's ear with surprising clarity. It reminded him of the sound of the crowd at the contest. Except the blades are not blunted now. Both sides are in deadly earnest. How many already dead this morning, I wonder? He turned to General Visbrook, sweating beside him in his immaculate uniform. Have you ever fought in a melee like that, General? A straight fight, toe-to-toe, at push of pike, as they say? Visbrook did not pause for a moment from squinting eagerly through his own eyeglass.
No, I have not.
I wouldn't recommend it. I have only done it once, and I am not keen to repeat the experience. He shifted the handle of his cane in his sweaty palm. Not that that's terribly likely now, of course. I fought on horseback often enough, charged small bodies of infantry, broke and pursued them. A noble business, cutting men down as they run. I earned all kinds of praise for it. I soon discovered a battle on foot is a different matter. The crush is so tight you can hardly take a breath, let alone perform acts of heroism. The heroes are the ones lucky enough to live through it. He snorted with joyless laughter. I remember being pushed up against a Gurkish officer, as close to each other as lovers. Neither one of us able to strike or do anything but snarl at each other. Spear points digging everywhere at random. Men pushed onto the weapons of their own side or crushed underfoot. More killed by mishap than design. The whole business is one giant mishap.
An ugly affair, muttered Visbrook. But it has to be done.
So it does. So it does. Glockta could see a Gurkish standard waving around above the boiling throng, silk flapping, tattered and stained. Stones flung from the broken walls above began to crash down amongst them. Men pressed in, helpless, shoulder to shoulder, unable to move. A great vat of boiling water was upended into their midst from high above. The Gurkish had lost all semblance of order as they came through the breach, and now the formless mass of men began to waver. The defenders pressed in on them from all sides, relentless, shoving with pike and shield, hacking with sword and axe, trampling the fallen under their boots.
"We're driving them back," came Visbrook's voice.
"Yes," muttered Glockta, peering through his eyeglass at the desperate fighting. "So it would seem, and my joy is limitless." The Gurkish assault had been surrounded and men were falling fast, stumbling back up the hill of rubble towards the breach. Gradually the survivors were driven out and down into the no-man's land behind, flatbows on the walls firing into the mass of men as they fled, spreading panic and murder. The vague sound of the defenders cheering filtered up to them on the walls of the citadel. One more assault defeated. Scores of Gurkish killed. But there are always more. If they break through the barricades and into the lower city, we are finished. They can keep coming as often as they like. We need only lose once, and the game is done. It would seem the day is ours. This one, at least. Glockta limped to the corner of the balcony and peered southwards through his eyeglass down into the bay and the southern sea beyond. There was nothing but calm water, glittering bright to the flat horizon. And still no sign of any Gurkish ships. Visbrook cleared his throat.
With the greatest of respect,
meaning none, I suppose.
The Gurkish have never been sailors. Is there any reason to suppose that they have ships now?
Only that an old black wizard appeared in my chambers in the dead of night and told me to watch out for some.
Simply because we fail to see a thing, it does not mean it is not there. The Emperor has us on the rack as it is. Perhaps he keeps his fleet in reserve, waiting for a better time, refusing to show his whole hand until he needs to. But with ships, he could blockade us, starve us out, get around our defenses. He need not have squandered all those soldiers. If the Emperor of Gurkul has one thing in abundance, General, it is more soldiers. They have made a workable breach.
Glockter scanned along the walls until he came to the other weak spot. He could see the great cracks in the masonry on the inside, shored up with heavy beams, with heaped-up rubble, but still bowing inwards, more each day.
And they will soon have another. They have filled the ditch in four places. Meanwhile, our numbers dwindle, our morale falters. They don't need ships.
But we have them. Glockter was surprised to find the general had stepped up close beside him and was speaking softly and urgently, looking earnestly into his eyes. Like a man proposing marriage, or treason, I wonder which we have here.
There is still time,
muttered Visbrook, his eyes swiveling nervously towards the door and back.
We control the bay. As long as we still hold the lower city, we hold the wharves. We can pull out the Union forces, the civilians at least. There are still some wives and children of officers left in the citadel, a scattering of merchants and craftsmen who settled in the upper city and are reluctant to leave. It could be done swiftly.
Glockter frowned.
True, perhaps, but the Archlector's orders were otherwise. The civilians can make their own arrangements if they so desire. The Union troops will not be going anywhere, except on to their funeral pyres, of course.
But Visbrook took his silence for encouragement.
If you were to give me the word, it could be done this very evening, and all away before—
And what will become of us all, General, when we step down onto Union soil? A tearful reunion with our masters in the Agrient? Some of us would soon be crying, I do not doubt. Or should we take the ships and sail to far-off Thuljuk, do you suppose, to live long lives of ease and plenty?
Glockter slowly shook his head.
It is a charming fantasy, but that's all it is. Our orders are to hold the city. There can be no surrender, no backing down, no sailing home.
No sailing home,
echoed Visbrook sourly.
Meanwhile the Gurkish press in closer every day. Our losses mount, and the lowest beggar in the city can see that we cannot hold the land walls for much longer. My men are close to mutiny, and the mercenaries are considerably less dependable. What would you have me tell them? That the closed council's orders do not include retreat?
Tell them that reinforcements will be here any day.
I've been telling them that for weeks.
Then a few more days should make no difference.
Visbrook blinked.
And might I ask when reinforcements will arrive?
Any, Glockter narrowed his eyes, day. Until then, we hold.
But why?
Visbrook's voice had gone high as a girl's.
What for? The task is impossible. The waste. Why, damn it?
Why? Always why? I grow bored of asking it.
If you think I know the Archlector's mind, you're an even bigger idiot than I supposed.
Glockter sucked slowly at his gums, thinking.
You are right about one thing, however. The land walls may fall at any moment. We must prepare to withdraw into the upper city.
But if we abandon the lower city, we abandon the docks. There can be no supplies brought in, no reinforcements, even if they do arrive. What of your fine speech to me, Superior? The walls of the upper city are too long and too weak? If the land walls fall, the city is doomed? We must defeat them there or not at all, you told me. If the docks are lost, there can be no escape.
My dear plump pudding of a general, do you not see it? Escape has never been an option.
Glockter grinned, showing Visbrook the empty holes in his teeth.
If one plan fails, we must try another. The situation, as you have so cleverly pointed out, is desperate. Believe me, I would prefer it if the Emperor simply gave up and went home, but I hardly think we can count on that, do you? Send word to Koska and Kadia. All civilians should be moved out of the lower city tonight. We may need to pull back at a moment's notice. At least I won't have to limp so far to reach the front lines. The upper city will scarcely hold so many. They will be lining the streets. Better than lining a grave pit. They will be sleeping in the squares and the hallways. Preferable to sleeping in the ground. There are thousands of them down there. Then the sooner you start, the better.
Glockter half-ducked back as he stepped through the doorway. The heat beyond was almost unbearable. The reek of sweat and burnt flesh tickled unpleasantly at his throat. He wiped his eyes, already running with tears, on the back of his trembling hand and squinted into the darkness. The three practicals took shape in the gloom. They were gathered round, masked faces lit from underneath by the angry orange of the brazier, all hard bright bone and hard dark shadow. Devils in hell. Vitari's shirt was soaked right through and stuck to her shoulders, furious creases cut into her face. Severard was stripped to the waist, gasping breath muffled through his mask, lank hair flapping with sweat. Frost was as wet as if he had stood out in the rain, fat drops running down his pale skin, jaw muscles locked and bulging. The only one in the room who showed no sign of discomfort was Schickel. The girl had an ecstatic smile across her face as Vitari ground the sizzling iron into her chest. Just as if it were the happiest moment of her life. Glockter swallowed as he watched, remembering being shown the brand himself. Remembering pleading, begging, blubbering for mercy. Remembering the feeling of the metal pressed into his skin. So searing hot, it feels almost cold. The mindless din of his own screams, the stink of his own flesh burning. He could smell it now. First you suffer it yourself, then you inflict it on others, then you order it done. Such is the pattern of life. He shrugged his aching shoulders and hobbled forwards into the room.
Progress? He croaked.
Severard straightened up, grunting and arching his back, wiped his forehead and flicked sweat onto the slimy floor.
I don't know about her, but I'm more than halfway to breaking.
We're getting nowhere,
snapped Vitari, tossing the black iron back in the brazier and sending up a shower of sparks.
We tried blades, we tried hammers, we tried water, we tried fire. She won't say a word. Fucking bitch is made of stone.
Softer than stone, hissed Severard. But she's nothing like us.
He took a knife from the table, the blade briefly flashing orange in the darkness, leaned forward and carved a long gash into Schickel's thin forearm. Her face barely even twitched while he did it. The wound hung open, glistening angry red. Severard dug his finger into it and twisted it round. Schickel showed not the slightest sign of being in pain. He pulled his finger out and held it up, rubbed the tip against his thumb.
Not even wet. It's like cutting into a weak old corpse.
Glockter felt his leg trembling, and he winced and slid into the spare seat.
Plainly, this is not normal.
Understatement, grunted Frost.
But she's not healing the way she was.
None of the cuts in her skin were closing, all hanging open, dead and dry as meat in a butcher's shop. Nor were the burns fading, charred black stripes across her skin like meat fresh from the grill.
Just sits there watching, said Severard, and not a word.
Glockter frowned. Can this really be what I had in mind when I joined the Inquisition? The torture of young girls? He wiped the wet from under his stinging eyes. But then,
This is both much more and much less than a girl. He remembered the hands clutching at him, the three practicals straining to pull her back. Much more and much less than human. We must not make the same mistakes we made with the first of the Magi.